Chat producer and lead host to So What's Your Story, and you are listening to KPFT, Houston's community station.
It is 6 p.m. Wednesday, and welcome to award-winning So What's Your Story, the only show in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, where we place the spotlight on ordinary people with extraordinary stories to tell, and you're going to find it here on KPFT, Houston's community station, 90.1 on the dial, or kpft.org. I am your host, Hank Rubicek, and each week, along with Mary Edgerton, Eric Heen, and Larry Thompson, we bring you the best in community radio, and we must be doing something right because thanks to your support, we've been doing it for 14 years. Retired lawyer Howard Lieberman is a nationally known storyteller who moved from Brooklyn to bucolic Stillwater, Minnesota in 1990. The best way to describe Howard is someone artistically ambidextrous because his performance skills doesn't end with storytelling. He's also a poet and was even regarded as one of the finest Jewish, Irish, Haley dancers in Manhattan. Only thing he doesn't do is sing, except maybe in the shower. Howard came to my attention through a mutual friend, Lauren Neely, himself an accomplished storyteller, who's been a guest on this show several times. In fact, Howard and Lauren collaborated on several projects, including the critically acclaimed 1967 and Alone and Testifying. And Howard has done some pretty magnificent solo performances, such as Death Camp Diaries, among others. Howard's unique signature brand of telling is filled with humor and laced with the rawness that only a true, authentic teller can convey. There's more to Howard Lieberman on our So What's Your Story Facebook page, but let's get to his stories. Howard, welcome. Thank you for being here. It's a pleasure. I hear great things about you. Don't disappoint us. And you're coming to us from Minnesota. Is it snowing there?
Not today.
Not today. Okay. But yeah, one of the really nice things about recording.
It's in the forecast for tomorrow.
Oh, great. Great. Yeah, welcome to Houston, where it's 93 in the shade. Okay, excellent. Now, your first story is entitled Shiva, as in sitting Shiva. And so many of your stories do a great job at really letting us see your life internally, and this is a unique way to start. Howard, in less than a minute or so, tell our listeners who do not know what sitting Shiva means, please.
When a loved one passes away in the Jewish faith, the community, the relatives, the family come together to provide solace to the survivors. And if you know anything about Jewish culture, that includes a lot of food, a lot of desserts, a lot of alcohol, and some prayers. And that's pretty much what Shiva is.
Yeah, good. Very good explanation. Very good. Let's hear your story.
My father left us when I was 9. He was kind of an interesting character. He was a tap dancer who got his first pair of tap shoes and his performance name from Bill Bojangles Robinson. So he was colorful. But he was also a really bad father, and he didn't much like me. I am not now, nor was I then, a typical guy's guy. I wasn't good at sports. I didn't like guy things. And so he just didn't have a lot of time for me. When my mother died when I was 14 from a massive heart attack that was badly diagnosed by her doctor, who just said, "Oh, you're just a nervous woman," and prescribed tranquilizers when she was clearly having heart problems. Her death really was a dagger to my heart. I was her daughter, the daughter she always wanted. She taught me to cook, clean, sew, iron, wax furniture. I learned how to make a home like a mother. And when she died, I no longer had a home to make. Now we sat Shiva at my rich relatives on the North Shore of Chicago. And the first day, the door opens. Some people come in who think they know me. They throw their arms around me. They hug me. They tell me how sorry they are. And the more they said they were sorry, the angrier I got. I mean, why were people saying they were sorry? Person after person after first person, food and drink, they put it on the table and they tell me how sorry they are. Well, if they were so sorry, why didn't they help my mother when she was working in a factory, helping to raise her two boys? We needed help. We needed them to be there, but they weren't there. They weren't there. So there was Shiva, people coming in, hugging Howie, and that was my name, Howie. And, you know, the pat on the head, the kiss on the cheek. And the second evening of Shiva, I decided I didn't want to be hugged by these people. I didn't want to be touched by these people. I went downstairs into the basement where there was a ping pong table. I put the back end of the ping pong table up. And while the noise and the laughter and all the rest was going on upstairs, I played ping pong by myself. Ka-ding, ka-ding, ka-ding. And only after I heard the din diminish and go away did I come up those stairs and go up to what was called my room, although it was just sharing a bedroom with a relative. And that's how things went. People would come, put the food down, kiss me, tell me they were sorry, that blah, blah, blah. And as soon as I could, I would make a beeline downstairs. And every night of the 7 days we sat Shiva, I got angrier and angrier and angrier. Ka-ding, ka-ding, ka-ding. I got quite good at ping pong, by the way. On the last night, one of my big uncles, Uncle Al, who never did a damn thing for me, never did a damn thing for my mother, except tell her all the things that she was doing wrong, pulled me aside before I could get downstairs to tell me how, Howie, you're a good boy. The rabbi tells me really good things about you that maybe one day you too could be a rabbi. And he pinches me on the cheek, which I hated. And then I went downstairs to my sinecure, my haven, my space away from all these people who don't really know me and didn't really care. Pa-ding, 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 pa-ding. I was playing a good game of ping pong with myself that last night. And as the noise diminished, I began to walk up those stairs for one more time, the last time, one step at a time. At one point, and I don't know where it was or when it was, what step, Howie went away. That nice Jewish boy who was good to his mother and who the rabbi thought would be one day a rabbi, he died right there. And when I opened the door and stepped out and I saw the leftovers and the empty liquor bottles and the detritus of my family, Howard looked around. And at that moment, he became a devoutly agnostic, anti-religious, left-wing Jew who hated his entire family, all his friends, being a Jew, and I think most of all, hated himself. I went up to my room that last night, and when I came down for breakfast, I told my aunt and I told my uncle I was done. I took my backpack and I threw some clothes into that backpack, a few books, notebooks and pens, and how he set off on a new life. And Howard set off on a new life. Thank you.
Wow. Howard, that's a beautiful story. If Howard's first name was an adjective, what would it be?
Opinionated, strident, defensive.
And what about Howie?
A good boy, a very good boy, yeah, who loved his mother and would be just the kind of kid you'd look at and say, gee, yeah, I wish my son was like that.
I appreciate that. I know that sounds like a strange question, but sometimes I ask that because it really gives us a sense of the transformation between the two characters. That's a beautiful story. Howard, you know, there are a lot of lessons, a lot of parables in every story we tell. If there's one takeaway that you want our listeners to take from this story, what would that be?
Think about what you say before you say it. If someone has lost a loved one, don't just say you're sorry. That feels hollow. If you find out that someone has a serious illness, again, don't say you're sorry and don't avoid them. Be real, be human.
Yeah. And that is, that's a more profound point than we think. You know, when I used to teach communication courses, I used to tell students all the time that be careful what you say, you can't take it back. You know, communication is inevitable. They didn't quite understand what that meant. And I would talk about measuring your words, but you're absolutely right. Be careful what you say. We make enough mistakes when we really are careful. So it really does pay to be very careful. And you know, whenever I would go to a funeral and I would hear people say things like, I'm sorry, or I don't know what to say, those are two responses that really disturb me. There's got to be something else. Now, this next story really reveals, I think, your repertoire and or your astonishingly interesting life, depending on your point of view, because it is called La Diabla. Let's hear it.
When you're homeless, you go where the road takes you. And sometime in the mid-60s, I'm on the road to Boston. I don't remember why, but I hitchhiked up there from wherever I was. And one night, I found myself sitting against a wall, just resting. I wasn't panhandling, although I did have my ball cap, my Chicago Cubs ball cap, on the ground next to me, but it was warm. And I did notice that people came by and occasionally put coins in that hat. And I did not stop them from doing so. But again, I was just resting. At one point, a very good-looking man, a black man, the blackest man I'd ever seen, wearing a white tank top t-shirt and very tight jeans, walked over towards me, reached in his pocket and pulled out a bill. And I'm thinking, wow, this is pretty good. Maybe I can actually find a real place to sleep tonight. He turns around and walks away, and those jeans did fit him very well in the back. I noticed, though, that he stopped, pivoted, turned around, and came back to me. And he looked down at me because I was still sitting on the sidewalk. And he said to me, do you have a place to stay tonight? Now, the answer was no, but I don't know who this person is. And when you're alone in a strange city, you can't take risks, because you could wind up dead. But I looked at him. He had nice eyes. I said, Howard, trust this person. I said, I really don't. He reached out his hand, helped me up. He said, come on, stay with me. And I went, okay. The worst he could do is kill me, right? And there are worse things in the world, I suspect. Well, we walked and we walked and we walked until we got to this row house, this brick old building like they have in Boston, where everything looks like it's pre-revolutionary. And we stop and he said, "This is my place. Come on up." And I did. He had the whole top floor of this townhouse, this row house, this brick house, whatever they call it. We walk in and he shows me around. He said, "This is my bedroom." He said, "Over here, this is my bedroom. It's big," I noticed, "and it had a balcony that looked over a park, a big, beautiful kitchen." And then he turns to me and he says, "That room over there, that will be your room, your room." Those words rang in my ears. We walk in. It was a smallish bedroom. It had a bed on one side, a big closet along the back wall, a chest of drawers or a bureau on another wall. And he said, "I'll leave you to get to know this room better." And when he stepped out of the room, the first thing you do when you're in a strange place and you're homeless is look to see if there's something you can steal. I don't feel good about myself for saying that, but that's true. And I went into his top drawer where most men keep their underwear, and I found a roll of bills, which I conveniently slipped into my pocket. I opened the closet, and there was a dozen hangers, each of which had a red velvet gown. And I'm thinking to myself, does a woman live here? What have I gotten myself into? And then I sensed his presence behind me. He said, "Those are mine." I didn't know what to say. I mean, what are you? I mean, those are your dresses? You're not a woman. He said, "I'm a drag queen. And those are my dresses. And my name on stage is La Diabla. And I work at a club downtown, and I'm really good." I tried to understand what he meant, because I didn't know what a drag queen was. But I learned. And I did ask him how he took care of the fact that he didn't have any, in polite company, breasts. But he showed me how he took care of that with the thing you put on that creates the illusion of breasts. And we talked. I went to sleep, scared out of my mind. Woke up the next morning to the smell of bacon and eggs and coffee. I got out of bed. I wasn't dead. Good. I walked in and La Diabla said, "I work every night, sometimes very late." He said, "Here's a card, and I'm going to write my number on the back. If you run into a problem, let me know. Oh, and by the way, here's a key. So you can come and go as you please. Consider this your place, your home." I hadn't heard that word, home, for quite a while. And so I did, and that was my life. I'd go out and hang out with the street kids. He'd come in whenever he'd come in. I'd wake up to coffee and eggs and bacon, and we developed a nice life. I learned a lot about what it means to be a drag queen, how to lip sync to music, and I'm pretty good at that, and just how to think differently about people like me. Now, I don't want to create the illusion that I suddenly become this all-accepting, decent, kind of liberal guy who saw the world through rose-colored glasses. And no, I did not immediately put back that roll of bills that I found in his top desk drawer, but it was a life. It was a life. And it was a good life. One night, I got a terrible migraine. I get migraines. I think it's a Jewish disease, but I get terrible migraines. This was the worst ever. And I thought I was going to die. I really thought I was going to die, and I didn't know what to do. I tried putting cold compresses on my head like my mother used to do. And finally, I didn't know what to do. So I called La Diabla. I called that number she gave me. And some gruff person says, "Yeah? What do you want?" I said, "Excuse me, I'm looking for for La Diabla. "Who the heck are you?" he said to me. I said, I'm her son. Tell her I think I'm dying." La Diabla got on the phone within minutes and said, "What's going on, my boy? What's going on, boy?" She always called me boy. I told her, "I'm dying. I have this horrible migraine headache. This could be the end of me." Nobody dies from migraines, but I didn't know that then. She said, "Stay where you are. Don't move." Within minutes, 20, La Diabla comes running in the door. She said, "Let's go." And she picked me up in her arms, her very strong arms, carried me downstairs out to the street, flagged the taxi with one hand, and took us to the Mass General Hospital. When we got to the emergency room, as you can imagine, there were a lot of people there. Didn't stop La Diabla. She said, "My boy is dying." And the woman behind the admittance desk said, yeah, sit down. Sit down, wait your turn." Well, La Diabla would have none of that. She grabbed me again and carried me in the back with the woman screaming, "Stop, you can't go back there." And we're in the back where the beds are and the curtains pull over. And I hear, "Yes, officer." They went into the, yeah. And two cops come in. And as they're about to throw us out or arrest us, a doctor holds up his hand and says, "They're okay. I got them." The doctor puts me in a bed. He said, "I'm going to guess that you've taken drugs before. I'm going to place an IV in your arm. Just as they say, go with it, and soon the migraine will be gone." I learned later that it was morphine. At some point, La Diabla carried me back outside, flagged a taxi, put me to bed, kissed me goodnight. And the next morning, with no pain in my head, I woke up to coffee and bacon and toast and all the rest. I told La Diabla, I don't plan to stay here forever, but you've given me a home." She said, "Stay as long as you like." And then the day came when it was time for me to leave. I couldn't bear to say to her face that I'm leaving now, but I took the money that I had stolen from her and put it back in the underwear drawer. I wrote her a long note that told her how much I loved her and how much I hoped to be as good a person when I grew up as she was to me. And I left. And I never came back. And I don't know if I'm as good a person as La Diabla was, but she made me better. Thank you.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you, Howard. You think she knew that you took money? Just didn't say anything? You think she probably knew?
Oh, yeah. She knew.
Yeah.
She knew.
Yeah.
And I think she knew that I put it back. At least I think she did. I don't know. Right. I hope she did.
That's an incredible story. That really is an incredible story. There was something that got you to trust her. And it's interesting, too, because she said, you know, "You're afraid and you trust her. I'm afraid." And of course, you're the one who initially, at least, was the thief. You know, you're the one she ought to be afraid of, at least initially. I love it when you kind of emphasize the fact that La Diabla said, "This is your room." You seem to say that with compassion and love when you said, "This is your room." Because she could have said, "This is the place you can stay tonight." But something was about her saying, "It's your room." It's a beautiful story. This is Hank Urbacek, and you've been listening to my guest storyteller, Howard Lieberman, on So What's Your Story on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. Howard, I'm going to just make a few announcements to these fine folks who are listening in. We are, everybody, in another KPFT fund drive. Yeah, again. But that's what it takes to keep listener-sponsored, corporate-free radio on the air. Your station, community station, Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 FM on the dial and kpft.org. So please give us a call at 713-526-5738. That's JAMKPFT. Go to option one, or please go to kpft.org, then to donations. And please, if you would, scroll to So What's Your Story as a show that you'd like to see continue on the KPFT inventory. And thank you for whatever you can do. We'd be so grateful. You know, many of you ask about storytelling venues in Houston, so let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. We meet virtually the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 Central Time. All you have to do is go to www.houstonstorytellers.org under events on the menu, and you're going to find the Zoom link to the monthly swaps. And while you're there, check out our annual Liars Contest to be held Thursday, May 18th. Take your story skills to the next level as well and join the Tejas Storytelling Association or the National Storytelling Network. And by the way, our friends at the Moth sponsor theme-centered storytelling events at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month. So get tickets online because they're always, always jammed. And also, if you have any suggestions for guests on this show, please shoot me an email at SWYS, of course, that's an acronym for So What's Your Story, at kpft.org. And please write on the subject line, guest. Just write guest. Howard, I know that you're thinking about getting into the Liars Contest, are you not? Yeah. And there you go. Right. You're going to be doing it. Yeah. And Howard's been coming. I wanted to emphasize the fact that Howard's in Minnesota and he's been coming to the guild meetings. One of the good things about doing it virtually is that we have people from all over the country come and join us. So please do so. Please, please do so. Howard, your next story is I think, poignant at the very start. On the tracks of Auschwitz, tell us a story.
In 2019, perhaps a few years before that, a Chabad, an Orthodox rabbi with whom I had traveled in the past, said, Howard, we're going to the death camps in Central Europe. And I'm thinking, why me? Why in the world would I want to do this? Remember, I defined myself as a devoutly agnostic, anti-religious, left-wing Jew. Why did I want to go and see these things? But I said yes. Well, I didn't say yes right away because I was going to do a solo show in the Minnesota Fringe Festival. And I got a good venue. That matters. That really does. So at first I said no. Yes, no, yes, no. I consulted with my friend Lauren Nemi, whose name you've heard, and he said, Howard, go and come back and do a show about how you experienced death camps. And Lauren's a wise man, so I said yes. And we traveled to many different death camps in several different countries. And then we got to Auschwitz. And we walked in along the train tracks, the rail tracks that brought in thousands and tens of thousands of Jews from all over Europe. They brought them there to die. Oh, to work some of them before they died, but make no mistake. And so we're walking in on the tracks under the sign that says, work will set you free. And as we get down towards the end of the tracks, on our right is the stairway down to the place where they told people, leave your belongings here. You're going to go down, you're going to take a shower, get all that dirt off of you. We'll get the bugs out of your hair. And when you come up on the other side, we'll give you back your luggage. Well, I knew in my heart of hearts that that isn't how it went. I knew from reading books that it definitely did not go that way. And I'm sitting there looking at this. The tracks, the sign, the people with whom I was traveling. And then the guide looks at me Tzachi was his name, which is a short for Yitzchak. He said, Howard, I want you to do a reading from Elie Wiesel's Night about coming to this very place with his mother and father and daughter and sister and how he reacted to that. I said, Tzachi, why me? Why? I don't want to do this. He said, you're a performer and you can bring this to life and none of these other people can. And so I agreed. About, we got to Auschwitz. People were told to get off either on the left or on the right. On the left meant they would work you to death. On the right meant that you would go directly to the showers, the Zyklon B showers made by the Bayer Corporation. And as I'm reading, tears are streaming down my face. I'm weeping. And I look over to the stairs going down where those people went and died. And I begin to see the ghosts of people, Jewish people going down those steps. And I see a woman, a sad, bedraggled woman, holding the hand of a little girl. And they're walking and they're beginning to descend. I'm weeping. I could barely get the words out. And they stop. And the little girl, she looks at me. She looks into my eyes and she says, please, mister, don't forget us. Don't forget me. Because if you don't forget me, I will never really die. And she stood there and looked, and I promised her that I would never, ever forget her. And away she went. And at that moment, at the moment that touched my soul, that basement door in the house where I sat Shiva, it opened again. But this time, Howie came up, and I began to remember who he was. And I can't tell you, and I won't tell you, that at that moment there was this miraculous recovery. Howard became Howie and became this wonderful person who would then reach out to the world and preach of love and respect for others. Because that would be a lie. But Howie did come up those stairs and take his place in my heart and soul. And he's never left. He's never left. Thank you.
What a beautiful connection. Thank you so much. As a docent at the Holocaust Museum, as you know, and listeners know this as well, you know, stories like this are just so incredibly poignant, and they make such an impression. It doesn't make any difference who you are, and this is no exception. Yeah, the original Dr. Death, Josef Mengele at Auschwitz. Auerbach, mach frei. Work will make you free. What a beautiful story. Thank you. Thank you. So now we go from Auschwitz to homeless in San Francisco. It doesn't sound like it's necessarily the place where you left your heart, as Tony Bennett would say, but tell us the story.
So I left the active practice of law and became a legal consultant, which meant that big law firms and corporations would come to me to help them develop their legal departments, help them with their finances, help them with a lot of different things. because in addition to a law degree, I have a graduate degree from Columbia School of International Affairs with a background in global finance. So I'm a pretty smart kid at that point. And I was in San Francisco to close a deal. And I did close the deal. It was a big, big deal. And to celebrate, I took off my suit. I showered. I put on designer jeans, expensive crocodile cowboy boots, a blue cotton chambray shirt, and an Italian custom-made sport coat. And I felt like $1 million. And when I left my suite at the Omni Hotel on California, the doorman wished me well because they knew me there. I was a big deal. And I walked down to the Embarcadero and I walked to a restaurant called The Slanted Door because I was going to treat myself to a good dinner and a client wouldn't have minded. Now, if you don't know The Slanted Door, it's probably the single most expensive Asian restaurant anywhere in the country. The food is good. It's always crowded, but I can always get a seat because they know me. And that was important, you know? And as I walked down there, I stopped to look at myself and the reflection in a big glass window. And I really liked who I saw. I really, you know, if you could see me now, you'd say, gee, you look pretty darn good. On the way back, there was what we would call a homeless man, an unhoused gentleman, sitting at his place just off California. I walked over and I reached into my pocket and I pulled out a bill. You see, most people, when they give money to unhoused people on the street, they put a few coins in. They think they're a big deal. I put paper in his hat that was sitting there. And I felt, good for you, Howard. You put a dollar bill into this poor person's hat. And I continued on my way back to the Omni, thinking about, well, maybe I should go get a really expensive glass of wine at that Italian place just down the street, because they know me too. But I decided not to. When I get back to the Omni, the doorman welcomes me. Welcome back, Mr. Lieberman. And I pause. I stop, actually, dead in my tracks. And I cursed. I cursed. And he looked at me. This doorman did. And I turned around. And I walked back down California until I found that unhoused man. And I apologized. And with tears streaming, I reached into my pocket and I pulled out 320s, which was all I had. And I put it in his hat. And I sat down and said, do you mind if I spend a few minutes and talk? He said, all right. I told him about my being homeless, about living on the street, about not knowing where the next meal would come from, and how I'd been thrown in jail for beating up a police officer who was, in fact, beating up on me. And I realized at that moment I had more kinship with this unhoused man than I did with my damn clients. He told me his story about having an okay job and a wife and a child. He lost his job. He got addicted. He lost his family. He lost everything and wound up on the streets. And he said, you know, you're a white person. I'm a black man. Our lives are not the same, and they weren't. But we talked all night long. And then I went out and I said, can I buy you breakfast? And he said, yes, and we had bacon and eggs and coffee and toast. And we went back to his spot. And I said to him, you know, I have a room at the Omni Hotel just up the way. Would you like to come and spend the night? Get a really good night's sleep. His eyes glazed over and he saw something that I couldn't see. It was somewhere. And then he turned to me and he said, get out of here. I don't want any charity from no white boy. I didn't say I was sorry. So I walked back to my hotel room, looking like I'd spent the night on the street. And the doorman opened the door for me. He didn't say, welcome back, Mr. Lieberman, at all. He didn't even look at me. I got into my room, my suite, and I locked the door, and I took a shower. And when I got out of the shower, I looked in the mirror, and who was looking back at me was a young boy whose name was once Howie, whose name became Howard. And he looked at me with a smile. And I said to him, from this day forward, I promise you that I will devote my life to social justice. I won't be a corporate shill anymore. I won't make big deals for big corporate law firms anymore. I will honor you, Howie and Howard. I fired my biggest client immediately, or they fired me, I don't remember which. And when I went home knowing that the road ahead for me was going to be difficult. But every time I looked in the mirror after that day, the person looking back at me, he looked pleased. He was glad that he was part of my soul. Thank you.
Thank you, Howard. You know, we have some time, so I'm gonna ask you some questions, which I think are really important. When you tell these stories, I know you tell these stories to a pretty large range of audience, right? I mean, you tell them to kids and don't. Yeah. What if you had to tell us, tell listeners what your goal is? Is there a goal that you want to achieve by telling these stories? I know we all have goals, we have missions, but do you have a particular goal in mind when you tell your stories? Because they're pretty prolific. They make some really good sense and they all deal with your transformation as a person, you know, metaphorically from Howie to Howard, Howard to Howie. What's your goal in telling these stories?
My goal is to create empathy, or at least to build empathy. People are comfortable with their own. Mm-hmm. They're not comfortable around unhoused people. They're not comfortable around poorer people. The professionals don't have any idea what the working people do. I try to use my life as a window through which people can look and gain empathy for the other.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way of phrasing it. I've always believed that stories, a good storyteller really does take listeners on a journey through their soul. They take them on a journey and then they return them safely to the present, like you did with your Auschwitz story. You take us to a terrible place and then you return us. And we can experience empathy. You know, storytelling is interesting because it also teaches us that you don't have to experience exactly the same thing in order to feel empathy. It doesn't sound very profound, right? But growing up, I was always told, well, you know, you've got to feel what that person feels. You've got to experience. But, you know, if I had my car stolen and I tell the story to six people who had their car stolen and I don't tell that story well, there's not going to be any empathy. It's not going to necessarily resonate. And I think that's the real magic of storytelling. You can make things resonate that otherwise it just wouldn't. You got involved in storytelling in sort of an interesting way. I know you told me the other day, how'd you get interested in storytelling? Tell us how you kind of got started as a storyteller.
Well, I've always been a person who liked to perform. I did everything from Guys and Dolls to open theater. I played Puck in A Midsummer Night's Dream, and it felt empty. Traditional theater is an imaginary world into which the voyeurs, also known as the audience, can peek in. And after a while, that left me cold, so I started doing solo performance art, which of course encompasses everything. And until one day, Laura Nemi said to me, "You're a storyteller." "I am not." "Yes, you are." "I am not." "Yes, you are." Because to me, storytelling was what like little old ladies would do in the library with little kids on their lap and talk about the big pumpkin in the sky or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that, by the way, is okay. I'm not diminishing that. But I realized I am a storyteller and I have a lot of stories to tell. And my stories don't always make people comfortable. I can do funny stories and I'll be doing a performance tomorrow night and it will have to do with me at the urinal at a baseball game. And it's a little slightly different story, but Lauren convinced me to be a storyteller. I started to go to NSN, National Storytelling Network functions. Some of the old timers wondered why they'd never seen me perform. And the next thing I know, I was on the board of directors of the National Storytelling Network. And my term ended several months ago. I'm very active in the storytelling community in different parts of the country and actually in India and other places in the world. And I decided that I am a storyteller and that's okay because storytelling is a spectrum from the little old lady, and I don't mean to sound so gender-based, from that little old person telling stories in the library. No. The, oh my God, can he really say that on stage wing? And I fit on that spectrum more towards the, oh my God, can he really say that on stage wing of the storytelling world.
Right. There are a lot of people who want to be storytellers, and oftentimes they'll ask me, you know, they'll say, "Hank, you know, I really want to be a storyteller, but I have no idea how to start. I don't really think I have any stories to tell because I'm not that interesting." What would you say to a person like that?
I would hug them and say, "I was sorry." No, that's a joke. Self-effacing humor. I would tell them, look, we all have lives we've been living. And within those lives, there are stories. Right. Think about if you would like to turn those events in your life into a performance art form known as storytelling. Mm-hmm. And not everybody in the storytelling world sees storytelling as a performance art form. I do. And then I would say, hey, go to a couple of events, see what others do, maybe take an introductory class. And you may find out that it's not your thing, and that's okay. But you might find out, gee, I really do like this. I think I can develop a skill for this. Mm-hmm. And just try it.
Yeah. Well, you know, theoretically, we're all natural storytellers. We really are. I mean, that's how we create meaning. You know, we use our verbal and nonverbal tools and we somehow try to make sense out of the world by telling a story because that's a really coherent way of articulating our thoughts and ideas. How, what's one of the best ways of documenting ideas for a story? Do you have any technique or methods or suggestions?
I do what I think a lot of writers in particular and performers do. I used to keep a notebook by my bed, and every time an idea would come up, because they always come up right before I fall asleep, mm-hmm. I would take some notes and I'd outline a story. Now, of course, I do it on my phone, which is right there, and at which point my wife says, "That's in my face, turn that thing off." But I still take a few minutes to, I create new stories all the time. Same with the poems I write and the essays I write. I would say, take notes and think about what's a good storyteller okay, knows how a story should begin to draw the audience in, know how to reach a dramatic arc, that place where you've got that the meat of the story, and know how a story ends. There are all kinds of storytellers. Some people will set up a music stand and read a story. Some people will memorize a story. I'm from the school that doesn't believe that that's storytelling. If you're reading, you're reading, you're not telling a story. If you've got it memorized, you're just doing an oral recitation. To me, a story has to come from inside of you. If I told you these four stories again now or tomorrow, they would be similar. The structures would be the same.
Right.
How they came out of me.
Right.
Very.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, but when you memorize a story, all you're really doing, as far as I'm concerned, is memorizing the words. You're not really learning the story. It's for certain that you're going to forget something. And as soon as you forget part of the story, you can't move on because you're thinking about the next word rather than the idea or how you connect the proverbial dots. Do you have a short poem, one of your short poems that you could share with us?
Sure. I didn't know you were going to ask that question, but
It's fun. Short poem.
Mm-hmm. All my poems are relatively short, which is a good one. Okay. Here's one. Not exactly a happy poem, but it's called Urban Coyotes.
Yeah, I'm not expecting anything happy from you, Howard, so don't worry about it. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Urban coyotes skulk in the shadows, waiting for vulnerable small mammals or food scraps to feed on. They're not naturally aggressive around human animals, which shows them to have strong survival instincts and a large dollop of common sense. Coyotes hunt and kill the bigger-brained mortals, but only for food, never for sport, never needing weapons beyond cunning and physical attributes. Abandoned youth are coyotes, moving silently among the stronger in search of sustenance and a pack for protection. Some survive, but none escape unscathed. Human coyotes are hard to spot, blending as they do with others. But look at the eyes. Their eyes never stop moving. Hear their cries in the night, calling out to those who share the blackness lingering in their souls. Urban coyotes look like domesticated dogs, but never pet one.
Very nice. Thank you. All right. Tell us how we reach you if we want your services as a storyteller. How do we reach you?
I'm redoing my website, and I will give you my email.
Okay.
And that's H Lieberman, H-L-I-E-B-E-R-M-A-N, at Lieberman-Nelson, N-E-L-S-O-N, .com. Or you can call me.
Or text me. All right.
I'll give you my number.
Okay.
It's area code 612-382-5200.
5200.
And you can find me on social media. I tend to not enjoy Twitter, and I enjoy it even less because of the new ownership. But I'm there, and I'm.
And if not, we can always find you in the basement, right?
Playing ping pong with my.
Oh, in the basement, playing ping pong. This was great. Thank you, Howard, so much. I really enjoyed this, and I'm also glad we had an opportunity to share some thoughts and ideas about you as a storyteller, how you got started, because I thought that was really insightful, and they were actually stories within a story. So I really do appreciate that. Everybody, the fund drive, 713-526-5738. Please give us a call, option one, and please donate whatever you can. Remember, this is listener-sponsored radio, corporate-free, KPFT. We need your help, or go online to kpft.org and then go to donations, and please scroll to So What's Your Story as the show that you would love to see hang around a while. I think you probably do, because after all, it's been around for a long time. We've been here for 14 years. Thanks to all of you, and we really appreciate it. Thank you, Howard Lieberman, for your wit, your wisdom, encased in every story. This was truly, truly a pleasure. I want everybody to know that when you listen to these stories, understand that they really do stretch the boundaries of the human heart. I want you to stay put for Living Art, that is hosted by Michael Woodson, another KPFT exclusive. Please make 90.1 a part of every day, and be sure to join us every Wednesday at 6 for Soap, What's Your Story? You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek, and along with the rest of the Soap, What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't necessarily end happily, it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Wind turbines are often kept from operating at their full potential. When consumer demand for energy falls, grid operators often turn down the output of wind farms instead of cutting the use of polluting coal plants. Sam Gomberg is senior energy analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He says operators often prioritize coal plants because contracts guarantee them a minimum level of production.
Instead of the grid operator telling the power plant when to run and how much, the power plant gets to tell the grid operator, we're going to run this much. So there's some legacy contract issues in place that don't give the grid operator as much control over coal power plants as they do over wind power plants.
He says it's slower and more difficult technologically to change the output of coal plants.
So they're not actually as flexible as wind power in this regard. And so in that case, they get a bit of a pass, which is unfortunate because it can create additional and excessive unnecessary pollution, and it can be more expensive than if you were able to rely on wind power.
So adding clean energy to the grid takes more than building new wind farms. It also requires making sure that grid operators can make the most of those farms that are already producing energy. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Make the connection between your favorite programs on KPFT and your power to keep them on the air. As a nonprofit organization, we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We count on listeners like you for donations, programming, and much of our staffing. That's how KPFT and Pacifica Radio work. Without listener support, 90.1 would be radio silence. Your contribution keeps the lights on, powers our transmitters, and covers our bandwidth. Becoming a member is quick, easy, tax-deductible, and secure. Just call or text GIVE to 713-526-5738 or go online to kpft.org. Become a member today and join the special group of heroes who keep KPFT on the air and free for everyone. You have